looking at chapter 3. The title of Brother Frank's class is The Benefits of Volunteering. And to help get our minds focused on Nehemiah chapter 3, we're going to have our brother Brian Robinson read Nehemiah chapter 3 for us.
Reading together from Nehemiah chapter 3. Then Elisha, the high priest, rose up with his brethren, the priests, and they builded the sheep gate. They sanctified it and set up the doors of it. Even unto the tower of Mia, they sanctified it, unto the tower of Hananiah. And next unto him builded the men of Jericho, and next to them builded Zachar, the son of Imri. But the fish gate did the sons of Hassanah build, who also laid the beams thereof, and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, and the bars thereof. And next unto them repaired Meremoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Koz. And next unto them repaired Meshullam, the son of Berechiah, the son of Meshezabeel. And next unto them repaired Zadok, the son of Baana. And next unto them the Tekoites repaired, but their nobles put not their necks to the work of the Lord. Moreover, the old gate repaired Jehoiada, the son of Paseah, and Meshullam, the son of Besodeah. They laid the beams thereof, and set up the doors thereof, and the locks thereof, and the bars thereof. And next unto them repaired Melatiah, the Gibeonite, and Jadon, the Meronothite, the men of Gibeon and of Mizpah, unto the throne of the governor on this side the river. Next unto them repaired Uzziel, the son of Harahiah, of the goldsmiths. Next unto him also repaired Hananiah, the son of one of the apothecaries, and they fortified Jerusalem unto the broad wall. And next unto them repaired Rephaiah, the son of Hur, the ruler of the half part of Jerusalem. And next unto them repaired Jediah, the son of Harumaph, even over against his house. And next unto him repaired Hattush, the son of Hashabaniah, Malchijah, the son of Haram, and Hashab, the son of Pathamoab, repaired the other piece, and the tower of the furnaces. And next unto him repaired Shalom, the son of Halohesh, the ruler of the half part of Jerusalem, he and his daughters. The valley gate repaired Hanan, and the inhabitants of Zenoa, they built it, and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, and the bars thereof, and 1,000 cubits on the wall unto the dung gate. But the dung gate repaired Malchiah, the son of Rechab, the ruler of part of Beth-Hakkerem. He built it and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, and the bars thereof. But the gate of the fountain repaired Shalom, the son of Kolhoze, the ruler of part of Mizpah. He built it and covered it and set up the doors thereof, the locks thereof, and the bars thereof, and the wall of the pool of Siloah by the king's garden, and unto the stairs that go down from the city of David. After him repaired Nehemiah, the son of Azbuk, the ruler of the half part of Bethzur, unto the place over against the sepulchres of David, and to the pool that was made, and unto the house of the mighty. After him repaired the Levites, Rehum, the son of Benai. Next unto him repaired Hashabiah, the ruler of the half part of Keli, in his part. After him repaired their brethren, Bavai, the son of Henadad, the ruler of the half part of Keilah. And next to him repaired Ezer, the son of Jeshua, the ruler of Mizpah, another piece over against the going up to the armory at the turning of the wall. After him Barak, the son of Zabai, earnestly repaired the other piece from the turning of the wall unto the door of the house of Eliashib, the high priest. After him repaired Meremoth, the son of Urijah, the son of Koz, another piece from the door of the house of Eliashib, even to the end of the house of Eliashib. And after him repaired the priests, the men of the plain. After him repaired Benjamin and Hashab over against their house. After him repaired Azariah, the son of Maaseiah, the son of Ananiah, by his house. After him repaired Binui, the son of Hanadad, another piece, from the house of Azariah unto the turning of the wall, even unto the corner. Palal, the son of Uzai, over against the turning of the wall, and the tower which lieth out from the king's high house, that was by the court of the prison. After him, Pedadiah, the son of Parosh. Moreover, the Nethinims dwelt in Ophel, unto the place over against the water gate, toward the east, and the tower that lieth out. After them, the Tekoites repaired another piece over against the great tower that lieth out, even unto the wall of Ophel. From above the horse gate repaired the priests, every one over against his house. After them repaired Zadok, the son of Immer, over against his house. After him repaired also Shimei, the son of Shechaniah, the keeper of the geese gate. After him repaired Hananiah, the son of Shelemiah, and Hanan, the sixth son of Zalaph, another piece. After him repaired Mishulam, the son of Barakiah, over against his chamber. After him repaired Malchiah, the goldsmith's son, unto the place of the Nethinims and of the merchants, over against the gate Mifkad, and to the going up of the corner. And between the going up of the corner unto the sheep gate, repaired the goldsmiths and the merchants.
Title of Brother Frank's third class is The Benefits of Volunteering, Brother Frank.
Well, thank you, Brian, for reading that chapter with all those names in it. But it is important to just think about what it says about some of those people. Obviously, a number of those people were not the kind of people you'd ever expect building a wall. Like it does say in verse 12, there was a ruler of half of the part of Jerusalem, he and his daughters. See how they all got into it. They got the spirit of, let's go out and build this wall. Let's rise and build. And they were there. I thought the Tekoites were interesting because it says in verse 5, their nobles put not their necks to the work of the Lord. But when you find them further on in the chapter, they repaired more than one piece. So, you know, there were some people quite ambitious. There were the goldsmiths and the merchants back in the latter part of the chapter. So there was really quite a mixture of people. Now, one of the things that we need to point out is, although we have a nice flat piece to work on here in our model, that's not Jerusalem. You get a little better idea here when you look at the how contoured the city really is. This is Mount Scopus. So looking down up to the top left would be where the old city is. This was the place, roughly the place anyway, of where the Roman generals were able to look down on the city of Jerusalem when they were planning the siege in AD 70. This is a very modern picture, so it shows the Hebrew university there, and not chariots, but actually cars lined up here. So it gives you a little idea of the city. I was quite surprised to find out how built up that place is. I thought, you know, well, it's been in ruins for all these years. It wouldn't be made. Oh, it's a big city, and it's really built up. In fact, Israel is trying to put more settlements around Jerusalem, I think, for the political side of it. But nevertheless, it's going to be the city of the future. When you're there and you're looking at it and you try to imagine what the Bible says about that city, it really is a sort of a bone-tingling kind of a feeling. And you think about, this is the place where God's placing his name. Of all the places in the world, this is the place. So it really is, if you ever get a chance to go to Israel, it's a wonderful place to go. Now, if we just look at the background of this little study, first of all, not all the people shared Nehemiah's vision of what ought to be done. Some were too entrenched in civilian life to really care about their spiritual well-being. Not many wanted to live in Jerusalem since the land was very productive and you could get away from people in other places. That's where they went. If you didn't live in Jerusalem, you didn't have to worry about fighting an enemy. So why not just join them anyway? Like, there really was not a strong group of people to get a volunteer group from. Like, there was enough of them, but there was just too many reasons why people were not interested, didn't. And by the way, I've only got nine groups lined up here. The way we want to do this is in your free time, you can come in, we'll assign you an area. So if anybody wants to do that, probably your last chance is just after this class. So you get the spirit of volunteering, like you gotta take a hold of this when you can. Now, where was all the help? Well, it tells us in Nehemiah 7, there was 42,303 score people came back from captivity. But when you look at the number of people that actually appeared on the wall, it couldn't have been anything like that. Maybe one-tenth of that. For a person who's interested in leading, that's an important statistic. You may get 1 out of 10 to actually help you in what you're doing. From the point of view of people who are leaders anyway and don't really see them ever to be leaders, we really do need a group of volunteers to make this work, because if Nehemiah didn't have the people that showed up to work, that work would not have been done. Nehemiah couldn't have done it. So the idea of a team, working together as a team, would really be a very valuable thing to cultivate. And that's why I was trying to suggest that if you come from an ecclesia, well, show your colors. Like, come over here and build your part of the wall. Yeah, put your name beside it, just so we know who actually built that piece. But there were about 5,000 meters of wall to be built. 5 kilometers. Oh, you don't talk in kilometers down here, do you? You talk in miles. Well, it's not quite 5 miles. It's a kilometer. In fact, we find that coming down from Canada, we used to what a kilometer is. Then you come down here and you have to go back to what a mile is again. A mile is huge compared to a kilometer. It takes so much longer to go 10 miles, so much longer in time. So you got 50 meters, or 5,000 meters of wall. You got 50 groups. Now you just think about this, just to try to figure out. You got 5,000 meters of wall and 50 groups. So each group had 100 meters of wall. Now, it may not have worked out that exactly, because there may have been a bigger group, they may have been more ambitious, some built more than one piece, but 100 meters of wall, a lot of wall. They built it in 52 days. So that means they build about 2 meters a day of that wall. Well, you're not just building it along, you're actually building it up. But they were busy, and it was hard, physical, dirty work. Come home exhausted. In fact, a lot of them didn't come home. They stayed right there on the wall with their families. They were obviously not eating too much. There wasn't much around to eat. They were living in poverty, probably in a famine, have little sleep. You know how well you get along with people when you don't have much sleep? Your parents have probably told you. It's not the best thing to work on relationships when you're very tired. So there was goldsmiths, perfumers, women, merchants, priests, rulers, all together on the wall. Just like a cross-section of us, there would be all these things in our group. We are working together. Now, many times in the Bible, you get this feeling of people working together. I want to just share a couple little points with you on this. One of them would be going back to 1 Samuel chapter 18 as to how do you tie people together. And this is one you wouldn't maybe suspect you would turn up, but I think this is key. 1 Samuel chapter 18, verse 1 says this: "It came to pass, when he had made an end of speaking unto Saul, that the soul of Jonathan was knit with the soul of David, and Jonathan loved him as his own soul." Now, how do you account for that? There has to be some reason for that to happen. It wasn't just that, all of a sudden he really loved David. There had to be a reason for it. It was after he talked to Saul. Does anyone ever have an idea of how that came about? Because it needs to be answered. And I think it's answered in the fact that these two men had one thing in common. They were both prepared to risk their life for what they believed. Jonathan had showed it before. You remember, he talked to his armor bearer, "Go up and let's take on the Philistines. And God can save with few, or he can save with many." So that the man, Jonathan, was a very faithful young man. But then David had just shown that he was very faithful, probably a younger man, and gone out against Goliath. That bonded those men. Now, when you're trying to find close friends in life, young people, it's really important to do this, to cultivate that, to try to find people who are really close friends. Very good for you in the ecclesia, very good for you personally. to have people that you would invite over to talk about issues that are troubling you. You wouldn't want to just tell everybody about them, but you'd like to just bounce them off other people, like, what do you think I should do, or what would you do under these circumstances? Well, what bonded them was their faith. And we know that it was a rather unique thing, because Jonathan's dad wanted to kill David, and Jonathan wanted to preserve him. And that little triangle relationship was, in the next few chapters, sort of took the chapters over, trying to describe what happened between those three characters in the Bible. But if you want bonding between other people, try it with faith. I can just honestly tell you, from looking back at my own experience, I would say the best bonding I ever did was preaching with other people about my own age, where you really got to know them and you were actually doing things that took a little bit of courage, standing up on the sidewalk, talking to people coming into a marketplace with other young people that were there with you, weren't alone. Just took a little more courage than normal. But it sort of bonded you together because both of you took the turn of doing that. And anything like that where you can bind yourself is the way to build the relationship, which is good for life. And I think, even here, when you look at the number of people that have signed up as a group, there's a bond there with that group. They're prepared to work together as a group. Well, you want to cultivate that because that's real strength to you spiritually later on. One of the things that I find is very, very challenging today is older people and younger people. Like, this is unique, young people. It's not happened before that I can ever remember. I don't know that history ever documents there's an age like we live in. This is called the information age. And the Bible talks about it. It says knowledge would be increased. People would run to and fro. And those two characteristics have got to be labeling characteristics of the age we live. There's never been an age when we've had access to information like we have now. Never has there been an age when people have been able to travel around the world and they're teenagers. People wouldn't do that. The great majority of people would never travel outside of their own area. Like, I found this. Dorothy and I had a reason to go to India over New Year's. And we got to India. I sort of couldn't believe that in this country, which is a lot smaller than America or Canada, there's 15 different languages. And these people haven't mingled. They haven't learned each other's language. So they get out of their little area of India. It's like a new country. It's India, but it's like a new country because they can't speak the language. They didn't travel. They haven't mixed. Whereas we in North America, we know people in California. We know people in British Columbia. Like, we know the parameters and the perimeters of the whole country because we travel. We mix. That's unique. That's not happened in history. And as a result, it's presenting new problems. And, as a teacher, quite often I just said, any of you guys know how to do this? And when you have a teacher, ask the students how to do something. Well, I'm not asking them to do what I teach. I teach mathematics. I'm asking them to make this computer work, which they know more about than I do. And I readily acknowledge that because that's the age in which we live. A teacher doesn't know more than another person that's younger in everything. It's quite possible that that young person will know more than the teacher. I just learned it's better to acknowledge that rather than try to deny it, because it's right. And if you can get young people to recognize that fact, you might even get young people to work with you and actually like you, or instead of going on making out you know something and they know you don't know it. And that's quite obvious when it comes to a computer. So what is this having, the effect this is having in the truth? Well, it's having, I think, quite a profound effect. And one of the things is that if you find that people you set up as an authority are only an authority in certain areas and they aren't in others, you might not really acknowledge it in your mind, but you really do despise the person in a sense. Like, okay, they're I could ask them questions that, but I wouldn't ask them questions in this because they really don't know anything about it, or I know more than they do. Well, that's unique because that's not something that history attests to has happened before. It's a characteristic of the information age. That people might be doctorates, but they're doctorates in such a narrow little area of their study, they might not know anything about something else, but we attribute that they're very knowledgeable because they're a doctorate in their own area. A lot of mistakes and myths associated with this information age. And here we are trying to, you know, pass the truth on to another generation. And I find it's in some cases quite a hard sell. Young people aren't buying into it. When, you know, I'm not quite that old, but when in our youth we went out to talk to people, the majority of the people in the Toronto area had a Bible, knew of the Bible. You could talk to them about Bible things. That was the average person. That's not true today. The average person today is not Bible-oriented at all. And as a result, we're trying to tell young people how to do things, and it's a different age. The age has changed so quick that we really can't tell you how to do things. And so the seminars have sprung up. Well, we never had seminars when I was a kid. You'd never even think of that. And the information age is providing new opportunities for you as things might be possible that weren't possible 10, 15 years ago. We went through an age, not an age, it's a long time, but through a period of time when Christadelphians were saying, well, it must be the time of the end because no one listens to us anymore, like no one ever comes out to our lectures, which was a total myth. Because as soon as someone, as they did, I think it was Randy Coy and David Noble, as soon as they come up with the seminars, people came out again. Now, it wasn't because the people changed their view of anything. It's just that seminars was the way to go about teaching them. And here we've been going through for years of time saying, well, you know, no one listens anymore, so we might as well just shut down the lectures because no one's going to come out anyway. Total folly. So that's part, I think, of the information age, and it's hard to pass the truth on, I find, in an age like that when you can't call upon your own experience to help people because the situation has changed. So the people had a mind to work that were there, even though there were an awful lot of people who didn't come. And they finished that wall in 52 days. And when you think of, as I said, how far apart they were on the wall and what they were able to accomplish and who they were that was working, it was really quite an achievement. Even the enemy, it says in Nehemiah, recognized that God had to be with these people. They could never have done this in the time they did, except God was with them. So this idea of letting rise up and build, as you've taken it, this particular class, rise up and build, as it comes out of Nehemiah chapter 2, they said, let us rise up and build. It's become sort of a motto. It's almost like something you want to put over the, you know, the wall of some room where you meet in, like in our, you know, if you have a Sunday school room where you meet, or you have in your meeting place, you have a place where you can put something over the where you speak just to let people think about these things. That would be a good one. Let's rise up and build, because the spirit of that is working together to accomplish the work of the truth. And there is much, much work to be done. One of the things which is a little bit humbling, but nevertheless good instruction, is to go to Haggai. Because in that prophecy, you can see a prime example of where people had they'd lost this vision. And the way they went about losing it was instructive. So it's a little hard to find because it's such a small book, but the prophecy of Haggai. See, it's associated with Nehemiah. And you might think that maybe a few people would have remembered this experience. But the way the book starts off with the prophecy of Haggai in chapter 1, verse 2, it says, thus speaketh Yahweh of hosts, saying, this people say the time has not come, the time that Yahweh's house should be built. So these people weren't doing things for what you might say was a reason that people couldn't exactly dispute and knock out, because they couldn't be sure that God really wanted them to build that temple. And when they tried to, there was going to be distress with the people around them. But the word of God came to the prophet Haggai, chapter 1, verse 3. And he said, is it time for you, O you, to dwell in your sealed houses and this house lie waste? Now, that is helpful because it tells us the kind of comparisons that we should make in our own life. The ceiled houses is the idea of paneled, like they were all nicely paneled and trimmed and decorated and everything was finished, like it was a finished house. And yet the temple at the time that he was speaking wasn't finished. It had been started, but it wasn't finished. And so he was trying to make the comparison in a person's mind. Look at what you're doing for yourself, but look at the state of the work of the Lord. Now, there is so much of the work of the Lord that that argument will always win out. It doesn't matter who you are or wherever you're doing. If you're spending all your time in your own house, you will be affected by that whenever you come to the book of Haggai to read it, where God says to you, well, my house is lying waste. Your house looks pretty good. You ever thought about that? So he says, consider your ways. And that becomes the sort of the motto of Haggai, consider your ways. Have you really got it right that you should be spending so much time on self and so little time on my work? And I find that that's a struggle when you're in your youth, because you look at your options, you know, no one's going to hire you for anything that you can live on unless you got some education. That's usually true today. There might be some occasions where it's not true, but it's usually true. You've got to have some education. So how much education? Well, you know, and what education? Are you going to do something that you like to do, or are you just going to try and get a job? Well, it's maybe 3, 2, 3, 4 years. And of course, for people who want to go, you know, postgraduate work, doctorate work, research work, I don't know how many years you could spend in this and still be a student. Now, that puts your mind in a dilemma. Could you say in your mind, well, I'm building my house with the hope that when I get it built, I will be in a better position to build God's house, which is reasonable. And you would imagine that maybe a lot of students actually have that idea in their mind, that I got to do this now for me, so I'm in a better position to do that for the Lord. Well, it would be a good idea to try to find a verse, because really that's the important thing. If you can find a verse and you can say, well, I really do think this verse is teaching me this, and this is why I'm following this counsel, but you don't find it. In fact, you find in this book of Haggai almost the very opposite. Like that should trigger a conscience problem with you. Why am I spending all this time? Now, I found that it doesn't mean you don't go to school. Like, don't take that from it, because I really think you have to get an education. But you don't have to spend all your time in it. Like, a lot of people are, you know, I shouldn't say a lot of people. Some people are 85, 90%, that's all I want. Well, if you're going to get 85, 90% in all your courses, you're going to have to spend a lot of time in it. Why don't you just be satisfied with, say, 75%? How much could you back off your time to spend it in other places? Like, that's decision-making that has to be made. And that's the kind of thing that God's saying. I don't think there is any justification, or else this exhortation wouldn't work. I don't think there's any justification for spending all your time on yourself, ever. And the better you get at it when you're young, to be able to say, well, what I'm going to do tonight, I got this thing I got to solve for school. I got something I got to do. But first of all, I'm going to do this, which I want to do, if you're like a broad category for the Lord. Whether it might be reading the Bible, it might be doing some work, calling somebody, working. Just try to organize your life and say, I'm not going to allow my schooling, my education, my work to take all my time, because I'm going to schedule my life so it can't. I found that's the only way you can do it sometimes, because your life will fill up with something. If you don't do anything, it will just fill up with all the things that, you know, when I look back on my life, a lot of the stuff I didn't need to do. Or when I was doing it, I was working so inefficiently, I might as well not have done anything, because I didn't get anything done anyway. It's really good to take that sort of attitude towards life. I'm just speaking to you as an older person who's gone through this same thing many times. Just schedule your life so that you do both, putting God first. And you can't help but remember that little occasion when Elijah was to be fed by that widow, you know, and she wasn't even of Israel. And when he went there, it seems very, very harsh that she says, well, I'm just going to make my last meal for me and my son, and that's it. And he says, well, that's right, but you make me one first. Now, what do you think that teaches? Like, look at the blessing that came to her life because she did it. But if she hadn't done that, it may not have worked out that way. We don't know for sure because we don't have the record to say anything other than it says. But that's the gist of it, that when you get into these situations of what you could do for the Lord, of how you could volunteer for it, often we argue ourselves out of it. I got too much work to do. I got a test tomorrow. I got an essay to write. I got some work to do. I brought home from the office. But you can do it after you do the work of the truth. If it's just a matter of picking the telephone up and spending 15 minutes talking to somebody who would really benefit from your call, that's only 15 minutes. You can waste that much time going to get a coffee. You know, it's all a game you play in your mind, but the way to play it is organize your life. Just force yourself, I'm going to do this tonight. This is the order of what I'm going to do. And if it is after your bedtime or you know you're tired, well, it's kind of nice to be tired when you've done what you know is right. I've never, ever felt bad coming home from a meeting, an ecclesial meeting, late, knowing I only got about 3 or 4 hours of sleep and off to work, because, well, that's what I ought to have been doing. That's being tired for a good reason. And you get through the next day. I just happen to have the fortunate case that most of my students are asleep and wouldn't know if I was asleep anyway. So it works out quite well for both of us. And if someone said to me, did you know you said that? I'd say, well, yeah, it's possible. Both of us were sleeping at the time. Now, another thing that I found, young people, that's really beneficial in volunteering is, if you ever watch the young child who's just starting to eat solid foods, and you give them something they've never tasted before, and quite often it's, they don't want it. Like it's, in some cases, they don't even want to start because they don't like the looks of it. I don't know why that occurs. But it seems that the Bible takes up on this. Can you go to Psalm 34? It illustrates that a lot of our problems, I think, are related to a fear that isn't justified. I can't do that, or I'm not going to enjoy that, or I won't work out, or I don't know those people, or whatever reason you can think of. And yet Psalm 34, verse 7, says, the angel of Yahweh encampeth round about them that fear him and delivereth them. Oh, taste and see that Yahweh is good. Blessed is the man that trusteth in him. Now, that's the spirit of volunteering in spiritual matters. It taste and see. You ever find a brother or sister who said, look, I work for the Lord and I don't like him as a master? I don't know. I've never found anybody who said that yet. But I've found a lot of people who said that, you know, that the experience, the payback of working in the Lord's service is really wonderful. I can remember something about my brother. I don't know that any of you would ever have known who my brother was because you're too young. But my brother Ron died when he was 43. He had 5 kids. Youngest child would be just maybe a month old. And all of us just fell apart. You know, just he just went out. He was a teacher at school, went out to play with the young people, floor hockey, and took a heart attack on the floor and died right there on the spot. And with all the work he was doing in the Lord, you know, we just couldn't understand how the Lord would ever do that. Like, you just imagine that if that's what God does for people who work for him, why work for him? And you have to sort of back off that. And it took us years of searching to come up with some kind of an answer. What was God doing? What is he trying to get us to see? And I often thought it was a very, very simple matter. Like, you can never challenge God on these things. It's a very, very unpleasant, hurtful, if not harmful, but hurtful things we have to go through where God sees, hey, this is what's needed. But we can't see that with our wisdom. We just think that life should be pleasant and go on. If you're serving God, it'll always work out right. But no, it doesn't always work out right. Sometimes it's tragic. you know, family goes down to the Caribbean to preach the word and take their family down there, and one of the children's killed in the Caribbean, come back with a child less than they went down with the aim of working in God's service. Well, is God working with you, or is God working against you? Well, one of the things that we must make sure we don't fall into is to think that God's unjust. If there's any problem, it's that we can't comprehend what God's doing, because we just do not see all of the things that he does. And some of the things he sees may be removed by years. We haven't got any ability to see in the future. So we've got to always say we will never cross that barrier that God's unjust. He is just. The problem has to be sorted out somewhere else. So going back to Ron, he was a tree farmer. He wasn't only a tree farmer, he was a teacher as well, but that's the way he was registered with a farm he was on. So he was planting trees and, you know, to get to the point where he harvest them. And one of the things that he often did was go down to the part of the bush where they had some very tall cedars. If you didn't cut the cedars down, they'd blow over. And a little cedar can stand being blown over for quite a long time, and the wood doesn't rot, yet it makes it very hard to get through the bush. So he'd go down there and he'd take these out. And he understood the principle that if you want these little trees around here to grow, the big one's got to go. Do you see where that applies? Like, that's God just made it that way. That, yeah, we do have leaders in the community, but don't expect them to stay. Because all of us are mortal. We're all subject to dying by accident, by suffering diseases. We got so many diseases now that people we're praying for, it's really becoming to our attention. We're all mortal. We're all suffering these things. So that unless there's a pool of people who are volunteering to take the places, recognizing that if you don't take the big tree out, the little ones don't have any light. Like, that's a principle of forestry, that you got to harvest the forest from time to time to continue the growth of the small trees. But that made more sense to me than anything else, to understand how, you know, he just suddenly removed from the scene, because he was one of these people who was a very good delegator, a leader and a delegator. He could get other people to do almost anything by just giving a phone call and, you know, come together and the work's done. But when he was taken out of the way, we didn't know how to do anything. We had to grow into knowing how to fill that gap. Years of learning that. Never really ever filling the shoes of anybody. You can't do that. But you can get on with the job and you can start doing what the other people were doing in little bits and pieces. And I thought that was really helpful. In the book of Haggai, God says, you know, this is wrong. You've got all your house all nicely paneled and, you know, the house for me up there, well, he hadn't even got it finished. And, you know, like in Nehemiah's time, well, I can't do that. Like, I'm a goldsmith. I work with jewelry. I work with my fingers, very fine things. I work with a magnifying glass. And God says, I want you to get up there and build my house. So he says this to them. I'm going to just go back to this because I didn't give you this information. You need this. This is a little tiny thing in Haggai that's so... You got to go back and find that book again. It's in chapter 1, verse 7. Thus saith Yahweh of hosts, consider your ways. Go up to the mountain and bring wood and build the house, and I will take pleasure in it, and I will be glorified, saith Yahweh. God doesn't look at it like we do. We would say, unless they've got that jewelry done exactly as I had it planned, so that can now be put on someone's neck or on a bracelet or something like that, the job is not done. It's no value in the job. And God says, no, that's not the way. All I want you to do is go up there and just start getting the wood. Like, go up there, and if you got to just chop the brush down so you can get into where the wood is, you're doing the work that will glorify me. And sometimes, young people, we get that confused. We think that, well, if I can't see how I can get the job finished and show somebody here's the work done, that it's no value. No, God's not saying that. He's saying you do the fundamental work to get it started. That will glorify me. Well, the time you go through the Bible passages on this, there's no reasons left for not. volunteering and getting on with the work. God's just preempted us on everything. Because one after another, he brings it to our attention. Consider your ways. Look at what you're doing. Look at what you should be doing. Get with the job. And so going to school, just to complete that circuit, is interesting because you can always be doing something. I'm not talking high school here. I'm talking, tertiary education, university, college or something. One of the things that my brother Ron did, which I admired him very much for, I didn't have the courage to do myself at that time, was he said, well, what I'm going to do is I'm going to get the authority from a student organization or something to put something on that notice board. So he went home and he designed a little cardboard sheet and he called it the Truth Seeker. And he took a little statement, something like, where people go when they die. And he wrote this down here and he said, any questions? And he built a little box and put a little slot in, put your questions in there. Questions will be answered next week. And when next week came, people come to the board to see, people are interested to see what the answer was. Oh, he got them torn down, thrown away. I don't know that there was anything beyond that. I mean, no one ever abused him. But the facts were he figured he couldn't go to school if he wasn't doing something like that. Now, young people, you can all do that. Like any one of us can take a piece of Bristol board into scissors, cut it up to trim it to size, and take some printing and print on it to advertise that, hey, we're seeking the truth. You want to join us in seeking the truth? Well, here's what we think the truth is on this issue. If you have any questions, put them in there. I'll answer them next week. That's where Rusted Scriptures got its formation. Like he started in university. And when he saw that there isn't anything that the truth can't answer. There's nobody can pose a question on what the Bible teaches that Christadelphians can't answer. That's the way Ron looked at it. And then, of course, he didn't know where this was going. That was the first we saw of it in his university days. Then he went down to the Caribbean. He spent some time in Guyana, took advantage of the fact that people didn't know what to do with their time, went out at night, started talking to people at night. He admitted that it was difficult, but once he got into it, he started to see again. Like people haven't got, we got the only answers there are to these questions. When he came back to Canada, we started up Allen Gardens. It was in the 60s. In Allen Gardens, you could still speak to people who roughly knew a bit about their Bible. And you could stand up and say, this is what I think the Bible says in public. No, now you're facing these people face on. And I must say, I joined him at that time. I developed a little courage myself in these matters. And there's nothing like being able to understand from firsthand information. People really start to say that is the truth. Like they understand it. When you're dead, you're dead. You can't be in heaven. You can't be tortured somewhere because you need to be raised again to live again. And you start to see this is the truth from another point of view. It's not from what they told me in Sunday school. It's not from what they told Dad and Mom told me. It's what now I'm finding. When I speak to the public who can say whatever they like, the truth is the truth. Well, that just opens up so many things. Now I think I could do this, and now I think I could do that. And you see, you've got to have that base to volunteer to get with the rest of the group and start working. Otherwise, you just go through, hardly ever doing anything spiritually because that's the way these things grow spiritually. Well, we're out of time, and there is something I think I can include in this next talk, which is, that will be the exhortation tomorrow, the source of strength. So we probably won't have this on tomorrow. But in tonight's class, I'd like to show you some of the things about Jerusalem and try to illustrate a few other areas where you can really build faith around the truth. Like when you start to see what this is and how God is showing us things in our day, in our generation. It's not as if it's always for some other people. Like there's things happening. They happened last week. I got this article. I'm going to show you this. There is an article that cut out of the paper last week that reinforces